Welcome to the Friends with Money podcast, brought to you by Money Magazine, creating financial freedom for Australians since 1999.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for another episode of the Friends with Money podcast. My name is Tom Watson, a senior journalist here at Money Magazine, and it's great to be with you once again. Today, we're digging into the topic of emotional intelligence and why it's actually, you know, so important when it comes to our everyday lives, but also the financial decisions we make. So to help us guide us through the conversation, I'm pleased to say that I'm joined by behavioral economist, psychologist, and regular money contributor, Phil Slade. Pleasure to have you with us today, Phil.
Great to be with you, Tom. It's a rainy day up here in Queensland, but we're hitting spring, and I always feel good when we hit spring. So happy days!
You sound like you have a spring in your step as well. I'm sorry, that was terrible. Before we
always after the good headline, aren't you?
Hey, it's my job. It's my job. Before we jump in, I should add that that Phil's actually penned a fascinating and much more comprehensive piece on this very subject for this month's edition of Money Magazine. So I'd strongly recommend picking up a copy of the mag and checking it out yourself if you haven't already. But let's get cracking. So Phil, to start us off, can you give us a bit of a breakdown of what emotional intelligence actually is?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have a few misconceptions about what emotional intelligence is. I think sometimes emotional intelligence is just sort of referred to as the suppression of emotion or not flipping out. And whilst that is definitely a part of it, it's actually not about suppressing anything. Suppression basically suggests that emotion is bad, you know, and that we have these emotions that get in the way of us making good decisions and trip us up. And that is true a lot of the time. But if all we do is suppress it, those emotions still kind of come out in maladaptive ways. Emotional intelligence is actually not about suppression. It's about understanding and managing emotion. So being able to pull apart in a useful conceptual way how to look at your own emotion and how to look in the emotions of others, and then understand intensity levels and what's the appropriate intensity level. How do you dial it up and dial it down based on the situation that's in front of you, and how do you help others to dial it up and down that's appropriate to that situation? You know, I often say, you know, there are times when you're at a concert or when you're, you know, about to go and do something together as a team where you actually want to dial the emotion up. You know, there's levels of excitement and things that you want to be able to dial up, but you can't remain at high activation all the time, right? So it's about managing those emotions, those energy levels. I mean, think about this more recently in terms of superpowers, right? And this emotion is actually the superpower that sits inside of us, that the thing that makes it a superpower is our the parts of our brain that are developed that scientists call system two, that is like our more conscious brain. It's our brain's frontal lobe that allows us to inhibit emotions, allows us to control emotion, that allows us to problem solve, to plan ahead. This part of our brain separates us from all other animals on the planet. But we've got a part of our brain that doesn't look any different from other animals on the planet, particularly in chimpanzees. And this is our highly emotional reactive, the long-term memories, our trauma memories, all these sorts of things that sit in the brains of many other animals. But they don't have this inhibitory control. So what you do when you see an ape in the wild is that they just get emotional. And you know that, you know, we've all sort of seen that the most scariest thing in the jungle is to see an ape that's highly emotional, because they've got no control. Who knows what they're going to do? They're just going to mass destruction. We've got a little part of that in our heads, right? So all of us have got this ape. We just have the ability to cage that ape and to use that ape and to release that ape when it's useful. I kind of think about it like different superheroes with laser powered eyes, you know, Cyclops in the X-Men, right?
Yeah.
He's got these laser powered eyes. That's his superpower, but he doesn't know how to control it. Or what he has to do is put on these glasses, right, to stop. And every time the glasses flip off his head, it's just mass destruction. And he sort of has no control over it at all. And so he has to suppress it with these glasses, and he ends up hating it. He ends up, you know, like hating the fact that he can't do anything, and it's like he sort of sees it as his biggest disability, right? Not his superpower. Whereas if you've got Superman has the same superpower. He can laser things with his eyes as well, but he's got the ability to dial it up and dial it back, to turn it off and on at will. He's not trying to suppress it because he's learned to understand, manage, and control it. And for me, that's like our emotions. If we don't know how to control it, that just becomes, you know, the moment that we flip off, the moment that we let the ape go, it's either ape rage time or it's nothing. It's all or nothing. And all you see is the damaging results of emotion. And so you think, okay, you just have to suppress it, just hide it, try to keep it locked away. Whereas emotional intelligence is about recognizing this superpower that we've all got, understanding it, and then managing it and applying that emotion in a constructive way, you know, given the circumstance.
I guess on regulation and all of this, so how does it relate to the way that we interact with our finances and when it comes to something like investing and I guess kind of relate to that? How does, you know, better regulation, better emotional intelligence help us make better financial decisions?
Yeah, look, I think we've got to maybe step back and have a look at a great experiment called the Dunedin experiment, which is a fantastic experiment where they took 1,000 four-year-olds in the early 70s, 1,038 or something, and started to test them over the time. They test everything about their physiology, about their socio-demographic information, their cultural information. And, you know, about over more than 950 of those original participants are still in this study. So you can imagine the amount of information that they've been able to garner over time. These are the guys that proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that smoking and lung cancer were highly correlated, for instance. So great. If you Google the Dunedin study, you'll get into their research, and they've just got pages and pages and reams of really fascinating research. But the reason that they started that experiment in the first place was they had a hypothesis. They wanted to see if they could see the next captain of industry, the next criminal mastermind, the next prime minister, the next president, somehow in those four-year-olds. Was there something in a four-year-old, a personality trait, a health trait, a habit that they would do that would somehow correlate with success in their health and success in their finances? And what they found was that none of the things that you think would make an impact had an impact. Didn't matter what marks you got at school. Didn't matter how rich your parents were. Didn't matter the cultural background. Didn't matter what language you spoke. Didn't even matter to a large extent what your family construction was. The only thing that correlated with success in your health and in your finances was emotional regulation, emotional intelligence. And this idea of being able to delay gratification, that was it. So delaying gratification is basically saying, my ape, my emotional self wants this right now, wants the chocolate cake right now. But I know if I say no to this chocolate cake right now, I will benefit later on by, you know, having more control over my weight, you know, the scales go down, or I will have more room later on to, you know, at the party later tonight, to not be as worried about what I'm eating, et cetera, right? So this is delayed gratification. And in order to do that, you have to be able to understand and manage emotion. Like it's one of the core things that sit at the heart of emotional intelligence. And it's this idea of delayed gratification that often makes people better investors or better users of their money. And when you couple expertise with emotional intelligence, because it's not just emotional intelligence, right? And I think this is where the article really delves into some really amazing stories of people that are actively investing and working with money and how it sort of applies. But in all cases, it's active expertise in an asset class or a business or something that you need that expertise, but that expertise needs to be coupled with emotional intelligence. And why that's important is because if you don't have expertise in an area, you're just blind to so much. You don't know what it is that is happening. You'd have no idea, you know, a decision or a news article or something that comes out today, you don't know, if you don't have expertise in that field, what the implications for that will be in 6 months' time. But if you don't have emotional intelligence coupled with that expertise, when, you know, crazy valuations of companies and companies start to go through the roof and all of a sudden a company triples in value, you need to be able to see not only that with an expertise lens that there's no way that a company can triple their output, with, you know, their valuation doesn't match their output. But the emotional intelligence needs to mitigate against fear of missing out when all these other people are saying, you've got to get on the bus. Look at all these other people. There's so much money to be made here. And you'll have advisors and you'll have people that know what they're doing, you know, and perceivably have got your best interests at heart, advising you to get on the train and all this sort of thing. And it takes that emotional intelligence to be able to step back, to be able to just take it for what it is, to be able to see the irrational way that the market might be moving, and have sort of the patience and fortitude to know not to do something. And that can be really hard. That can, not doing something can be a much harder decision than a decision to do something, particularly if you've got the finances to be doing something. You've got, you know, maybe 10 grand to invest and you just want to invest it, right? Mm. The idea to wait until you get the right investment can be really, really hard. Or even when we look at buying a house, right? And the house market's up and you've got this sort of, there's all sorts of fears and anxieties and things that happen around buying a house, or emotional attachments that you want because you want a certain area to live in because it says something about your identity and all these sorts of things. That it's a very emotional purchase. When you're buying a family home, very rarely is it a rational thing. It's an emotional thing, right? So having emotional intelligence helps you navigate auctions better. You know, auctions are sort of set up to have apes playing off with apes. You know, the salespeople like people like their apes being activated, right? They're trying to up the emotion. They're trying to up the drama, because totally. The more activated you are emotionally, the less likely you are to make rational decisions, the more likely you are to make instinctive decisions. And the interesting thing about that, and this may be a little side pot, is that when we make instinctive decisions, often we post-rationalize those decisions as, oh, it was a good decision because of all these sorts of things. It was like training emotional intelligence, you know, they sort of said, is emotional intelligence linked with IQ? And it's not. It really isn't. It doesn't matter. One of those things that the Dunedin study proved was your IQ doesn't have a good correlation with how much you learn. I know a whole lot of people that are really smart. They've got PhDs that are working in universities whose lives are a mess and their finances are in the toilet, you know. So IQ, and often, you know, teaching emotional intelligence to people with high IQ is really hard because they've got such good mechanisms for post-justifying their poor and irrational behavior. And so, you know, intelligence often gets in the way of learning good emotional intelligence. You kind of have to not abandon, but you have to put that aside and realize that emotional intelligence is a muscle that you have to work out, a muscle that, just like if you'd never pumped weights before and you started to pump weights, it hurts. And you might be competent in other areas of your life. You might be a competent runner, for instance, but have never pumped weights, and you go and pump weights. Just because you're a good runner doesn't make you a good weightlifter, right? So emotional intelligence is the same. Just because you're good in one area of your life and IQ and learning and all that sorts of things might be one area you think you're good at, doesn't mean that you're going to be very good at the area of emotional intelligence. But if you work it out, you can change it.
What are some of the ways that people can, you know, help improve their emotional intelligence if it is kind of like, you know, going to a gym and lifting weights over time? Is that possible to improve it?
Absolutely. You know, it's like anything. It's a muscle. So the more you exercise it, the more it will become stronger. I think the starting place is using language. We've got to have a language that allows us to be a little bit more specific about our emotions rather than just happy, sad, excited, angry. You know, all of those sorts of emotions are amazing. But if I said to you, how are you feeling? And you said sad, that doesn't tell me anything about how sad you are. You know, that's the follow-up question. And therefore, I'm in an awkward position of going, well, do I pick under the hood a little bit and go, oh, how sad? You know, are we about to have a half-hour, you know, couch conversation here? What Pandora's box am I going to open? And so people don't know how to do it. So they just go, how are you feeling? They just go, I'm fine. You know, I'm fine. So saying you're sad is not that useful. Being able to say, I'm disappointed. And disappointed is a level of sadness. It's a low level of sadness because you're disappointed about the loss of an expectation of something that's going to be happening in the future. So you're disappointed. Or you might be discouraged, which is a little bit more sad than disappointed, right? It's not quite. Or you might be actually hopeless. You know, you might just have a day where you just don't feel like you've got hope. You can't sort of see out at the end of the day. And we all have those days where we just, the hope just seems to drain out of our lifeblood. And so you might be hopeless, right? And that's kind of a middle activation. But if you're grieving, well, that's a different story. There's a whole another lot. And even above that, if you're in anguish or despair, then okay, now we need to have a talk about it, right? But it's only at that higher levels of activation that it becomes problematic. So creating and practicing talking, using language that has a degree of arousal attached to your words. And that's how we talk about emotion. The more aroused you are, the more likely the ape is to be in control and the less likely you are to be in control. So if you're anxious, for instance, if you're panicking or you're overwhelmed, this is not good. Your ape's in control and you've got no, you're panicking because you're losing money on the market or something like that, and you can feel panic. Being anxious is not the problem. Panicking is the problem, right? Being overwhelmed is the problem. Actually, you want a little bit of anxiety when things are a bit sturdy because you need some vigilance and you need to keep your eye on the ball. If you're losing lots of money and the market's going crazy and you're just peaceful, then there's a problem, brother. Like you need to be a little bit anxious, right? But there's a difference between yes. being concerned and panicking, right? And even sometimes when someone else is panicking, the way you show cognitive empathy for them is to be concerned about the thing that they're panicking about. Mm. When someone's panicking, the worst thing you can do is say, just calm down, right? It's just going to make them go ballistic. Or if they're angry and you say, just calm down, right? That's a sure sign for nuclear explosion.
I'm sure many of us have been guilty of doing that before as well.
Mm-hmm. I know, I have as well, right? And we do this in our relationships all the time. But just having that language to be able to say to somebody, you know, I'm in despair, for instance, or I'm grieving about something. If you're then able in that moment just to say, I'm really disappointed for your loss. Like I'm sad that you know, and you can tell that person that you're feeling a level of sadness at a lower level of arousal, then they calm down, you know, because being at that high level of arousal isn't good for anyone at any stage. So that I think is the first time. And there is an emotion wheel that I think is going to be in the magazine.
That's right.
In the article that's coming out. But you can also just search for Decider 5-Level Emotion Wheel and you'll find it on the web. That to me is a great way to start this conversation, and you can have a look at all the emotions and figure out how to dial it up and back. You know, you can be too excited or too happy. Being too happy or excited isn't that great. But being able to dial it back so that you're in control of that emotion, even in the positive emotions, as we call them, is the game. It's not about it's not about positive or negative emotions. It's actually about arousal level and making sure that we're not high arousal, because the times when it's appropriate to be in high arousal are 1% maybe of our life, maybe. I mean, I'm making it up. That's not a scientific assumption, but realistically, there's very, very rare are the times that we need that high arousal. But even when it is appropriate to be furious at something, the key is to be able to quickly dial it back. Creating some time that we can reflect on our own behavior is also crucially important. Put out 10 minutes of your day. And we've got a 10-minute journal that we like to use, but it's 10 minutes ideally in the morning or night, but even just 10 minutes a day, just to reflect back on what happened yesterday, what happened today, whenever it is that you're journaling, and how can you do better tomorrow? It's about an infinite game. This is not about going, what's your big goal? How do you get to this end state that's amazing? But just starting to play the infinite game with yourself, with your own emotions. And to do that, you need to reflect. You can't just be banging from day to day to day, just bouncing between one crisis to the next, one relationship issue to the next, and just expect that it's all going to become better one day. That's crazy, right? You need to be able to reflect and be able to practice the art of reflection and practice just being a little bit better tomorrow than you are today, better today than you are yesterday. And in part of that reflection is also in that moment, creating distance between this small gap between thought and behavior. And if you can pry that gap between the moment that you have a thought and then trying to act, if you can just a few milliseconds, a couple of seconds, you know, that there is an eon of implication that sits in that gap between thought and action. And that's part of reflection, right? Because that gap, even that few seconds, allows reflection, allows you to respond in a more rational way rather than just simply react in an emotional way. And the final thing is, I think, you know, practice mindfulness. And I think mindfulness and mindfulness activities have got a bit of a bad rap for a lot of people, particularly in financial circles, because it just feels a bit soft. It feels like a bit woo-woo, you know, like or a bit of an excuse just to check out for a bit. And mindfulness is not about some sort of spiritual practice. I think mindfulness is more about just practicing simply being in the moment. So I think both of those things, getting a lexicon, using the emotion wheel, so some language that allows you to build the conceptual framework that you need in order to hang sort of your learnings off, which is the language. You know, you can't think about anything that you don't have a word for. Yeah, think about that. You know, can you think about something that you can't say? You can't, right? You just, it's impossible, right? So you need those words, and you need those words to mean something. So that's where the emotion wheel creates a framework for that conceptual understanding. Practice dialing it up and dialing it down, you know, as appropriate. And that'll take time. You know, the kids are a great way to really practice that dialing it up and dialing it down. When you really want to flip your lid and lose the plot, how do you dial it down so that you're still angry, you're still anxious at a lower level? Create some reflection time, you know, do some journaling and pry the distance between thought and action, and then just be mindful and practice being in the moment. And that is something that you can practice.
It's a good reminder just to let things flow as well. We are going to have to leave it there for today, but this has been a fascinating chat. So, Phil, thank you so much for coming on and joining us and explaining things so well.
Look, it's been great to have a chat. And if anyone wants to reach out, they can catch me on LinkedIn. They can look at decider.co or switchforschools.com.au, I should say. And there's a whole lot of resources about emotional intelligence and things to do. And you can reach out and have a chat. We're more than happy to have a chat with people that want to continue the conversation and continue their journey to better emotional intelligence. It's part of the things that motivates us to make it a better world tomorrow.
Awesome. Thank you, Phil. Before we go, if you enjoy listening to Friends with Money, you can really help us out by sharing it with a friend or family member or by leaving us a review on iTunes or the Apple Podcast app. We'd also love to hear from you if you have any questions, comments, or even other story ideas. So to send something our way, make sure you use our dedicated email, which is podcast@moneymag.com.au. You can also keep up to date with all the latest news on property, investing, shares, and all things finance by heading over to moneymag.com.au. And don't forget that if you would like to read Phil's article in full, as well as a whole trove of other excellent pieces, then pick yourself up a copy of the October edition of Money Magazine, which is on sale now. That's it for this episode of the Friends of Money podcast, though, but we'll be back in your feeds next week. I'm Tom Watson. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Friends with Money podcast. For credible, independent, and easy to understand financial commentary, visit moneymag.com.au. Please remember that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are general in nature, and further independent advice and research based on your personal circumstances should be sought before making an investment decision.